Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hey everybody, welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis, on a beautiful Monday, spring Monday here in D.C., full of pollen, and but it's a pool day, so I'm happy. So those of you that follow us on broadcast radio know that that show's more of a variety show with lots of guests and lots going on, and this show, there's lots going on.
It's not a variety show.
This is not. It's a deep dive into a single subject, and the single subject now is entrepreneurship in the hospitality industry. Our guest tonight is Sarah Vandell. She's the founder and CEO of Plum Relish. That's a D.C.-based hospitality startup that works with local chef-driven restaurants to deliver catered bento box lunches to large groups.
No, you're sort of oversimplifying.
Well, that's how they describe it on their website.
I know, but there's so much more.
Okay,
that
do you
they
mind?
Do.
This is our first fight, everybody. Okay. So, do you mind if I finish?
All right, finish.
And with her is Kingsley Onyechi. He's the director of operations and partner services for Plum Relish, and he thinks I'm great, even if you don't.
Well, so that's okay. You guys
how about
are like
them apples.
You guys are like dressed like you and Kingsley.
You know
like
what?
Twins.
I woke up this morning. I said, Kingsley, don't wear a black shirt. He said, I'm wearing my black shirt.
So he's also like 8 inches taller than you, so nobody's going to get confused. But I also want to introduce our spirited advisor, is in once again, Todd Thrasher.
Yay!
Who wants to kill me and take over this microphone? But it ain't going to happen.
I'm also in entrepreneurship.
Oh, well, we can't hear you anyways because your mic's off.
Oh my God,
we're
going to
fix that. That's all right.
Issues.
Don't turn his mic on.
No. Turn the man's
no
mic
thrasher.
On. He's got a cocktail in front of us. Isn't his glassware fabulous? Do you need to come over here? Yeah, come over here.
Sorry. All right. So
yeah, I'm...
is this like in The Kingsman where you put something in my drink and I die?
It is, so I can have your spot. I can become the Beast.
Forget it.
So I'm also opening... I don't know if you know. I'm opening a new bar and distillery. Did you know that?
Oh, my God. Is that true?
It's a true story.
Wait. Is it on the wharf?
It is. It's on the water. Yeah, okay. It's on the water. Amazing. So this is a cocktail that is inspired by my time going to Bonaire. This is called Wet Money. So I'm a big scuba diver, and when you go diving, you always have some cash in your pocket. And in Bonaire, we go to this little town called Rincon, and there's a sign when you come through the town after you go on your dives. And we usually do this as the last dive of the day, so we can get our Polar beer and
this
drink.
This is you and your wife, Maria.
Me and my wife, and you know Tristan has now gone with us too. He hasn't dove yet, but...
He
does go with us. So there's a place, and it's called, we call it the coldest beer place because there's a sign that says the coldest beer on the island.
Uh-huh.
And we always get...
Oh, do they have trouble with spilling there?
They do have trouble with spilling.
Because they went to college?
No, because they drink too much Polar. Mm. So this is inspired by this because the lady at the counter when we go to get our beer after the dive, she said, I don't want your wet money.
Okay.
So wet money is wet money. When you get out of the ocean, it's wet. So this cocktail has salt water in it, tequila, vodka, passion fruit juice, and
a
little lime.
Oh, it's passion fruit. I thought it was pineapple.
Yeah.
It's delicious.
We don't want your wet money.
I don't know.
No,
I kind of feel
no
funny,
money.
Though. I think I'm passing out.
No, you're
you drank
fine.
Half of it already.
Todd, please take over the microphone.
No, thanks very much. Right. Have a nice day.
All right. So let's get back to Plum
Relish. Nice to see you, Sarah.
Thank you.
All right. So, Sarah, why don't we... take it from the top. Are you a natural born entrepreneur? Did you always have a lemonade stand and you know,
absolutely not.
Girl Scout cookies or
no?
What?
No, I mean, you know, it's funny. I never saw myself as starting a company. And I think when I decided to start one, I'm like, I am now going to be an entrepreneur. But no, I think if you're disciplined and you have drive and you see a need in the market, and I think it just the need just overtook what I wanted to do.
Well, so let's start there. What was this need that you were interested in filling?
Yeah, so I was at the advisory board downtown DC. We were doing a ton of catering. And what I could never understand was why weren't the current restaurants doing better food? Why are we going
How
to...
How long ago are we talking about?
So 3 years ago.
Okay.
So
not that long ago.
No, not that long ago. Feels like a long time ago.
That's what happens when you start your own
business. Yeah. 3 years ago, I decided I wanted to find this niche. More people, I think as consumers, we care about our food. We want to know where it's from. And DC is a big, has become an enormous food community. It's like the entrepreneur of food. Like, everyone's filling needs left and right. And it's just, a lot of the food out there got stale. So the catering companies.
Well,
in
all candor, a lot of the food that comes from, you know, just when you're, and I'm not talking about the big caterers and all of that, but when you cater a lunch at an office for 25 people, some of the food that shows up is stale.
Yeah.
It's crap.
Sad desk lunch is what they call it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it's a real thing. And I think the exciting part about it was I was in an office, and so I knew what it was like to get a bad lunch, and I also knew what it was like to get a good lunch, and that feeling of both just, wow, this is going to make my afternoon so much better, and at the same time, the employer is paying for it. So if you're going to spend money on employees, you want it to go to a good part. So,
okay, so you thought that there was a real hole in catered lunches,
mm-hmm.
specific.
Yes.
So how did you go about deciding how to fill that hole?
Did you look at becoming a caterer in and of itself? Yeah,
right. I mean, like, what did you, yeah. were you like, yeah, I can do this better?
And literally, I just gave notice, and 2 months later, like, out the door, we're going to start serving food. I don't know how we're going to do it, but I knew that if you can serve food in bulk, you can make it operationally efficient, you can make it profitable. And what I saw that was not working was like the Postmates and the DoorDash and just getting lunch to you individually, which is completely subsidized.
Right. Well, and also that's individual. You
yes.
know, so like you can't use really those kinds of companies for group functions.
Right, exactly.
Not successful.
Yeah.
You know, like you could try, but it's really hard. It's not successful.
I want to know, was Kingsley there too? And did you make him leave his secure, safe job for this dream?
Kingsley's a good story. He joined us recently. And, you know, the reason I asked him to join us was he came from Kava. He was at Living Social. And he's, you know, 3 years later, we're in a position to have someone like Kingsley on our team, which we're really excited about to scale faster.
Mm-hmm.
And so he recently joined us, and we're lucky to have him.
Okay, so we're going to get to you, Kingsley, in a little bit, because I feel like we're starting at the beginning, and as we grow throughout our show today, then we can incorporate
you and I can just
in.
Sit here and drink.
Yeah,
yes,
sounds good.
Exactly.
Sounds
Todd will be back with another drink, so don't overdo. Okay, so you're like, yeah, I'm just going to provide catering services to the area.
Yeah, I had a simple question, is why couldn't we get better food to the office during the day?
And what were you envisioning? Like, to you, what was the answer to that question? Because I know in my head what the answer to that question is. I feel as a woman personally that food, especially at catered functions when you're going for office lunches, is either skews completely masculine,
mm-hmm.
heavy carbs, right? Or, you know, for women, they put together like a measly salad with like a little piece of protein, like nothing's composed.
Yeah, it's a complete afterthought.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, one out of two millennials think they're a foodie. And so that gives everyone the right to say, this is what I want.
I would say three out of two.
I was going to say, that makes me laugh. Listen, everybody can have the title. Have at it. Be a foodie. I love it. But I think that's amazing.
Right. They self-identify, right?
Right.
It's like, I'm signaling to you, I care about what I want to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I think a lot of women in general tend to be silent. They're like, oh, I'm just so thankful I don't have to make my lunch. But then they just end up sitting there with lunch because our department was 95% female.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our clients are 97% female. They're the ones who are ordering for the office. So, you know, it's a business where the squeaky wheel kind of gets the grease, where the person who's like, why aren't we getting barbecue? Or like, I want those big sandwiches. But there's a quiet majority of people that really care. And so it took us 2 years to figure out the optimal menu. And, you know, we started with three items, and then, you know, we see.
So what were those three? How did you start?
Yeah, we started with one assumption, which is let's give people enough variety. And honestly, there's a company out of Tokyo, Japan, that does 70,000 lunches a day in bentos. And we started with that premise, and they.
Okay, I want to back up a little bit. Why bento boxes for a catering luncheon? Like, why instead of like platters or something like that? Food waste? Like, what are you thinking?
Yeah. So one is people don't like their food touching, which is.
What's wrong with those people? No, just joking.
My peas are touching my mashed potatoes.
I mean, just a little bit of judgment.
We could talk about the school lunch that helps support us, but I will tell you adults are not any less picky than children. So
you mean finicky is what you mean.
Picky.
Quirky.
Yeah, quirky.
Like, no one diets anymore. It's all food restrictions, right? Like, I'm vegan before six, or I'm not eating gluten, right?
Did she say before six? Or
yeah, like VB6, Mark Bittman's book. We actually tried that for a summer.
See?
You
would have loved it.
But I will be honest with you. Like, if I was out to lunch and I didn't have an option, I was like, whatever.
And shameless plug, Mark Bittman's on Foodie and the Beast next Sunday.
Not this coming Sunday, the following
after
March
20th. Mother's Day.
Yeah,
sorry.
He'll be in studio.
Yeah.
I'm very excited. Right.
No, I mean, we see 15 to 20% of people order vegan every day.
Okay.
And we started with vegetarian, and then we completely nixed it because there were too many people who just were not eating dairy but wouldn't classify as vegetarian. And so the only way to please them was, like, let's just do good vegan.
Well, okay, so what does that look like?
So actually...
Is this like what you did originally? Like your original bento?
So our original bento was just like this. We did three options. One was a meat. One was anything the chef wanted to do or we wanted to produce. And the third option was a vegetarian dish.
Okay, well, who was the chef initially?
So initially, funny enough, Todd Thrasher and...
Who? Oh, yes.
The Eat Good Food Group. You know, they're a fantastic restaurant group from Alexandria. They do really creative things. And they have a catering kitchen with Society Fair. And so we started...
All right. So is it Cajal or Cajal?
Cajal. You know Cajal.
I know who it
Seriously?
Is.
Seriously?
I've heard people pronounce it 50 different ways.
I know, but you know him personally.
Of course
you
I know him
exactly
personally.
How
I'm also
pronounced.
Afraid of him now that he knows jiu-jitsu or
I know.
Whatever.
Yeah. He's fierce.
Wait. I want to even get in between...
No. She's in the middle of talking about something.
Wait. Because there are two issues here. One is convincing restaurants to let you do this.
We're not there yet.
And the other is, yes, we are.
No, we're not.
I am. Okay. And then the other is, you know, going out and going to corporations and saying, hey, we can do this for you.
Yeah.
So when you went to
so chicken and egg.
Cajal.
It's complicated.
How did did you walk in and say, I got this great idea, man? I mean, how did that work?
Actually, I met Michelle. First, and just said I had met her at an event.
She's a ball of fire.
She's creative.
Her.
She's great. And I said, you know, I think there's a way to be profitable with lunch production and do it in a different way that is made based on how people are actually eating, not what's traditionally been done.
Okay.
And so we.
So was your sales pitch initially to her? Like, did you go to her first?
So we had started, I mean, I've probably, like, it's 3 years. So we've gone up and down, up and down. We had brought in the chef, and we had designed menus. And then I was like, this is not going to work. And then I had met Michelle, and she was like, oh, we could do this. And so we started working with them. And then right before we served our first lunch, we had the field school come to us and said they're redoing their lunch program. Would we be interested, considering we were doing lunch? And Cajal. it's his passion project, and I think he is one of the big people in DC who has always wanted to do a school lunch.
Right.
And for
that. But originally, he wanted to do school lunches for like the underserved areas,
yes.
Like the public schools.
Yeah. I mean, we can spend 10 hours talking about
right. That's a total
crazy,
other story.
How crazy it is.
Right. That's
and
another story.
I think, the good part about working with not public schools is that you don't have food restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard to comply. Forget about the budget and the cost.
It's out the window.
Yeah.
Right.
So we launched with them and kind of diverted our attention to bootstrap the company. And I drove our school lunch delivery van for like the first 2 months.
So it's funny that that's where you were able to bootstrap your company.
Yeah.
Because you would really think that that would be the harder place to make money.
It was.
Okay.
Well, when did you start the crowdfunding and all of that?
So we started the crowdfunding in May of 2015 and did Kickstarter in June of 2015. We served our first office lunch that July.
But you were already feeding the school at that point?
Started,
like which came first?
So we started feeding the school that September.
Okay.
But we had talked to the school before we fed our first office lunch. So we knew we were going to be doing that.
All right. So it took you about, a year to get everything up and running?
I think we're still getting up
and running. You know what I mean.
Yes, yes. I mean, we... we went through the first half of school with the Armstrongs and then figuring out how to do the corporate side. And ultimately we realized like we needed to really dig in and dig deep. And so we ended up going into our own shared kitchen because we wanted to make changes really fast. And honestly, I think the benefit of working with them and working with the restaurants we work with now is that this is a fifth priority for people. And like part of why Kingsley has come in is to optimize a lot of our operations so that you're better utilizing your labor hours, et cetera, et cetera. And so we needed to figure that out. And we were not going to be able to figure it out if we had someone else producing.
Okay, so now you're producing.
Yep. So we went in and right. we went into our own kitchen for 18 months. Mm-hmm. And we had some really good chefs in town who had consulted and helped us. And then we decided, the biggest factor for me was about a year ago, so around this time last year, we had this kind of eureka moment of how can, we were selling more lunches out of our own kitchen and no one knew who we were, but it was good food than some restaurant groups that had catering.
Right.
And so I went to them and I said, you know, the biggest thing in catering to introduce new caterers is people want to try your food. But I'm like, well, if you work with partners like Founding Farmers, you don't need to say, well, I need to try that to trust it. It's like you already do. So we wanted to eliminate that step. And so we went to the restaurants and said, we know exactly how to cost this out. We know how you can make this extremely profitable for you. We'll do all of the legwork. Like, is this something you're interested in? And I actually called Rob Wilder, mm-hmm, and
Think Food Group.
Yeah, who has just been a really good sounding board. And I'm like, I have this crazy way we're going to take the company. And he was like, interesting.
Okay, so I just want to clarify. So where you've taken the company to, you were making your own food. You worked with Cajal.
Mm-hmm.
Was he creating that food? Like, or was he, doing what? That's where I'm a little confused.
Yeah, so we launched with the school lunch.
Right.
And then we had worked with the Society Fair kitchen for a couple of months on our corporate lunch. And then we decided to do it in-house in like end of 2015, early 2016. So we had been doing it until we closed our kitchen down in August this year.
Okay.
Last year.
So now you're, I don't want to say outsourcing, but
no, we partner with restaurants.
You partner with restaurants.
Yes,
they prepare the food.
Yes.
You provide all the packaging.
Yep.
You do the delivery and all of that.
Okay, so you provide all the packaging and you do all the delivery. That's accurate.
Yes.
Yes.
So all they do is make the food.
And
all
you do the sales. You do everything.
Yeah, and the difference is we go to them. We say to them, "You have a great menu. Mm-hmm. We're going to make sure that it's going to taste really good at ambient temperature, so served cold to room temperature." And we're going to take bits and pieces of it. We're going to make sure some of it's gluten-free, some of it is vegan, paleo, and we're going to do all of that for you and spit that menu back out. This is a lunch menu, just like you would have a happy hour menu or a brunch menu. Like, this is your drop-off catering lunch menu.
Okay, so let's talk about who are the restaurants you're working with right now?
Yeah, so we work with Founding Farmers, Chico, Colada Shop, Succotash, and the respective restaurant groups.
Yeah. Okay. Who's going to Chico tomorrow night for her birthday?
We're going there for dinner.
Oh,
tomorrow.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, it's so good.
Yes.
But now they don't do lunch.
They don't, which is part of, you know,
it probably really works for them.
It works well for them. You know, lunchtime dining right now, it's at its lowest level in 40 years.
It's true.
Right. People
because
are not,
of fast casual.
Yeah. I mean, if I could sit down with every restaurant.
Right. You're with Cava. You guys started the trend.
It's true.
Yeah. I mean, if I could sit
so
down.
So Kingsley, you ruined everything.
Yeah, Kingsley, you're a part of the problem.
I mean,
that's
I
why he came.
So.
Right. Yeah. No, if I could sit down with every restaurateur, I think they should be able to answer, like, do you have a lunch program during the week, or is it better for you not to?
Right. Where are you losing your money and how are you losing it?
Yeah.
No, like I always talk to people, you know, Penn Quarter is one of those areas, mm-hmm, where all the restaurants want to do lunch, right? And people are not willing to, they're willing to leave their office and stand online for a half hour at Taco Bamba,
yes,
right?
Yes.
To wait for tacos, but they would not go there and spend a half hour and have lunch at Del Campo.
Right. I mean,
it's just, it's a mind thing.
It was also a price thing too. I mean,
well, but you could eat that's not true. You could eat just as reasonably if you chose to.
It's all convenience.
Right.
20% of people don't even eat lunch anymore. You know, like
those people I don't understand.
One out of three meals a day is now a bar, like a breakfast bar. You know, we're not in the suburbs, but people eat that, like, that's now a meal.
Okay, I do eat that for breakfast.
That's totally
not a
wrong
breakfast bar, but I do eat a bar. I do eat my sesame seed
bars. Wait, and
but
you're a foodie.
I know, but
yeah,
I like them. They're
but, you
tasty
know, that's where fast casuals like you know, the Kavas of the world and rotis have done really well because they are convenient. And that's why they've taken catering away from traditional caterers.
Well, they're not just convenient.
They're delicious.
Right. Well, that's, I think, the story that Fast Casual sells, whether you talk about Chico or Kava or Honeygrow or Sweetgreen or any of the local ones, especially, you know, like Taylor and et cetera, is that they tell a story that you can come here, you can get really good food, healthy if you want it, and it's not going to cost you that much money, but it's not a McDonald's, and it's not a, you know, it's not a Subway. It's not some sort of chain restaurant that's serving, you know, poor quality food.
So one of our listeners has just asked a question, and the question is from Adam Hurst of Rockville, Maryland.
Hello, Adam.
Hello, Adam.
Thank you for listening.
He wants to know
today
why you don't offer breakfast catering, then, if that's the case.
Oh, she's like, damn, I don't know.
Well, we get asked this all the time, and we always refer them to, like, Colada Shop does great breakfast catering.
But you don't want to get into it yet.
It's a totally different meal and for catering. I mean, generally, what I say is people who purchase breakfast catering don't want to purchase lunch catering. So
that probably makes sense.
And logistically, traffic is terrible.
Yeah.
So it's a whole different ballgame. And I think for the way we want to scale and how we want to start, you have to have like a laser focus. So it's not that we don't want to do it. It's just we don't want to do it.
You
right
want to
now
start there. Okay. Yep. So now let's talk about your partnerships and how you're working with these partnerships. What does, let's say, Founding Farmers do? Like, what are their offerings and how often do they change, and how do you work with them so that their offerings are what your clients are looking for?
Yeah, I mean, the advantage we had in being in our own kitchen is we came to everyone with data and said, this is how people are actually eating. So we look at the menu, we send them a first draft, and we say, is this, we know, we understand operationally how it will be. We know how to pull things from their menu, and they look at it and they're like, okay, we're going to sign off on this, this, and this. And then we tweak it.
But don't you have to go to your customers and your prospects, your prospective customers first, and say, you know, here's the world of opportunity here. What kind of stuff do you guys like?
Yeah, I mean,
doesn't it start there?
Yeah, I mean, we were very deliberate at this stage of who we partner with, based on popularity and appeal. And, you know, Chico is not Founding Farmers, and they have totally different audiences.
Right. Well, all right, we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to talk about, yeah, time flies when you're when your mics work. This is David and Nikki Nellis.
You're funny. This should be a comedy show.
I know, I'm super funny. This is Industry Night. We'll be back in just a sec.
Service Radio is made possible by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. Learn more at simplecast.com.
Okay, we're back on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis. We're talking to Sarah Vandell, who is the founder and CEO of Plum Relish, and her Director of Operations and Partner Services, Kingsley Onyechi. And it's all about really creating a new model for catering to, you know, corporate customers, to bring them lunch and not bring them the usual platter crap that, you know, what do you call it? Sad lunch day?
Sad lunches.
Sad lunches.
Sad lunches. Sad lunches.
So what we were talking about right before we took a break is how you work with your partners. And I guess my question is, I have so many questions, but one of them is, so like Chico does catering, and they also do delivery. Now, I know they don't do lunch, but what did you say to them that they were like, oh yeah, this is a no-brainer? What was it?
So I would say, well, particularly with them, we had been successful with our first restaurant partners. But what we say to these restaurant groups, and you know, Kingsley can also speak to this, is operationally, we help you better utilize your labor hours. So, you know, staying in compliance and optimizing your off hours with your cooks is probably where you can get the most profits. And so we said to them, listen, you know, we will do it. You have no risk in doing this with us. So it's not just a marketing cost, but the reason why our partners like us and we like them is, you know, it comes in your branded bag. You know, it's done through you. Like, we take full responsibility.
Well, let's talk about how that works a little, because if all right, I got a bunch of questions on the corporate side, but on the on the delivery side, if I'm Chico, do you have Chico branded bento boxes? And you,
so look, she brought the founding farmers.
All right, and
bag.
So you deliver a bunch
powered
of those to them.
Powered by Plum Relish.
And when you go pick them up, they're in a bento box that has a Chico or a founding farmers logo on it.
Exactly.
I got you. Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Yep. So it's one thing, I think, when chefs make food that they know is going to be cared for and it's in their name, they do a better job.
Of course.
And these kitchens are very efficient. So a lot of them haven't done catering to the extent, but they're, you know, they function at a very high level, so they don't make mistakes. It's very different than like the Postmates and that type of stuff that's going out the door, but this is, it's pretty specific.
So how do you work with them to construct their menus? How many offerings do they have to have? How do you work with them?
What is it? Five. Three signature meals, one vegan, one vegetarian.
Yeah, everybody has to offer.
Yes.
So five
is
total.
Is this what's in front of us typical of what,
yes,
say, a founding farmer's? I can't see everything that.
Yes. Yeah, so there's chicken, salmon. This is cauliflower steaks.
Yep.
Right. So
yep.
It's beautiful.
And herbs.
This is tenderloin.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Wow.
So, and a lot of surprising, when we talk to the restaurants, oh, what's interesting is they have a lot of types of cold food already on their menu, or really good garnishes that can be used, like slaws that are paleo friendly. Like, there's a lot of stuff that you can say to a chef and be like, oh my gosh, you actually have a gluten-free menu. You just don't advertise it as that.
Right. You just don't realize it.
And they don't realize it either. And so I'm like, you can please so many people if you just tell them.
Okay.
And so that's what we do.
And so where do you fit in on this?
So I see myself as fitting in from a finance and operations perspective, but really, you know, Sarah doesn't really need any help outside of just passing on.
That's a big lie.
You have a pretty steep resume, so I believe you are adding something to the equation.
So, you know, one thing that really allowed me to gravitate towards what I do now is, one, my love for food. Two, my love for finance, and three.
Doesn't everybody really like finance?
I mean, I only like finance when it's coming in. Not when
so every restaurant, right? I feel like there are four things they all worry about. They worry about revenue stream, they worry about marketing, they worry about their food costs, and they worry about their labor, right? So what Plum Relish does is, one, through marketing, you can see obviously the founding farmer bags. These lids usually come with stickers. Mm-hmm. So from a marketing perspective, the
Cover.
Restaurants are set.
Check.
From there.
Okay.
Correct.
So check.
Correct. And you know, piggybacking on what Sarah said earlier, you know, Postmates and Uber, no offense to them, they just don't cut it. They don't care about what the customer feels when they get their food.
But they're also not, I don't feel like they're really going after the large catering gigs. Like,
no,
what
not.
You guys are doing,
right.
This is not for the individual, right? This
right.
is just for the larger
that
catering
gig.
So I feel like you've created your own little, niche. There are restaurants that are trying to get those lunch gigs. I mean, but they're looking to do mostly platters, maybe some do boxes. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know
and
anybody.
Not only that, but their marketing area is about an 8-block radius. You know,
right.
Correct.
Yeah.
And, but essentially,
yeah.
you could still go through Caviar and order a meal for 10 people, right? From
right.
Chico, right? But when we make that delivery or that catered service, we want them to, you know, to feel like we are an extension of Chico. So that's kind of the difference between what we do and what, you know, a quote-unquote delivery.
Well, how do you get the hot foods there?
They're
hot,
not hot.
And the cold foods?
It's all room temperature.
It's all room temperature.
Yeah, that's been the key since day one. We had to put a stake in the ground. I mean, the reason why we lump ourselves together with on-demand is because restaurants do, because they just see things as food we feed people in our brick and mortar and then food we feed people outside.
Right.
And the way they look at these third-party companies is really like a frenemy, because a lot of times they're not making... It's not profitable
The percentage is pretty big.
Yeah.
Like, I know Uber Eats takes quite a chunk of change, and Caviar too, right? They both do.
Yeah, it's huge. And I think the restaurants are going to get smarter as they think about how they want this food to go out the door. And so the difference is they see us as like, how is this different? Whereas our customers and offices don't, like, it's very different for them. Mm-hmm. But from a restaurant, it's exclusive menus that we work with them on. So it's like, let's hold your hand and go through this, and we'll treat your customers just the way you would want us to, as if we were part of your host stand.
That takes a lot of trust.
So what's your dream amount of restaurants that you're offering? Like, is there too many?
Yes.
Is there a sweet spot? What do you think?
So in D.C.
Yeah, right. Just starting here.
In D.C., the answer is all the best restaurants that feed as many people. Like, we say no to a lot of restaurants. If you can think of a restaurant, we've probably talked to them. Mm-hmm. We get a lot of inbound requests, and we're small. Like, we've been pretty deliberate.
So what's the vetting process?
Honestly, I would never say that we're foodies. We like food. But the vetting right now is who are great partners to us? Who do we really trust? Who do people trust in terms of their food and how, you know, they treat people and just everything, I think, about that restaurant group. And that's what's popular, like where you can just snap your finger and people say, oh yeah, I would love that food.
Right. And then how do you access the public?
So right now it's to date, it's been pretty much word of mouth.
Do you deal with, like, you go into, if you were going to Geico, do you go to the HR director and say,
it's word of mouth.
Yeah. No. But I mean, who's
our buyer? It's usually someone who is an office manager, executive assistant, someone who has a corporate credit card who has to make the decision mm-hmm. on lunch, which is a thankless job. It's like feeding 40 people, and everyone comes to you and is like, can you remember not to order onions this time? It's, you know, it's tough.
Right. I'm gluten-free. I'm vegan. I'm pescatarian.
Yes.
Right.
I get it.
Flexitarian. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I don't like Diet Coke. I like Diet Pepsi.
Keto. Yeah. Today, what was the request we got? No apples, no grapes, some dish. Mm. I mean, it's just, you know.
No, that's totally keto.
So we
no sugar.
Yeah. We vet the menus beforehand, and then we never customize them again. So if you have a group of 40, you can't say to us, we want to swap these sides. It's all done.
It's done. So this is the menu.
Yes.
You get what you get. You don't get upset.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So moving forward, so now you're still bringing in money, right?
Like, yes.
Didn't you just get a big investment?
We did.
Okay. What was that about? Like, how'd you go about doing that?
Oh, man. That's another tale to tell. No, it was really exciting for us. Starting an early stage company in the food tech space, which, by the way, no one wants to fund. I mean, because
I feel
why
like,
do you call wait. It food tech?
Because it's scalable,
right?
And it's not all food and it's not all tech,
right?
So there are a lot.
What about the tech part? Don't you understand? He doesn't understand why you're calling it tech.
I mean,
right?
Yeah, food.
It's food, but we can scale. So we've built everything in house. So in terms of like how you order and how the kitchen sees their order, so all of that behind the scenes, like we have a fantastic CTO, Leanne Hogg, who is leading our efforts there.
Oh, I see. It's the behind the scenes.
Yeah,
stuff,
I mean, we built this to spec. So like the reason we were successful for the first 18 months, we took that learning and we know exactly how a chef wants to see their PDF print off. In the
right.
kitchen.
Got it.
So it's you know, when I think about the business that we should be in, it's that let the restaurants produce the food mm-hmm. and like we will help them and hold their hand all the way through.
So you're really just providing, so it you're
we're
you're
shared whole, service.
Yeah. So you really changed from what you started
yes.
doing. It's totally done
yes.
like a 180.
Yes.
That's really fascinating. But this is the way, but that's how these businesses grow, and this is how you make money.
Yeah, this right? is how we grow. And this is how we're ultimately the most helpful.
Mm-hmm.
People want restaurant food.
Right.
They don't want nameless catering food, no matter how good it is.
It's
right?
true. No, it's absolutely
and
true.
It's, because when we bring founding farmers to offices, like there are people who look at it and they're like, oh, this is so good. And they haven't even had it. Or Chico, it's like, if, you know, we delivered to McLean and they're like, I've been wanting to get to Capitol Hill to try this. And this is amazing.
Well, right. that's the other question. What's the you know, sort of the radius of the delivery radius, if you will?
So generally out to Bethesda, Tysons, McLean. Virginia is a larger market for us. It's just not surprising.
Sure.
And you have a lot of big companies out there and headquarters
especially
out there.
Especially with Tysons.
Oh, yeah. So it is insane. So there's no shortage of that. And that's a real advantage for these restaurants that are, you know, Succotash is a fantastic partner of ours and getting their food out there. And, I've been surprised at how, like, receptive people are. Even Colada Shop. Like, they do a great catered lunch.
Well, Colada also has two properties. They're not just down here. They're also in Virginia.
Yes. And they're also involved with, you know, that team came from Think Food Group.
Right.
Like, they're A-plus at everything. Mm-hmm. So, and I feel lucky to work with them. And it's nice to work with, you know, Daniela Senior from Colada Shop and Mario Monti. I can name a list of everyone we love working with, but they're one of them.
Okay, so let's just go back. So we were talking about your fundraising effort. We sort of trailed away on calling it food tech space.
Yes.
But it does seem like there are lots of people right now who are investing in food tech and food concepts
in a way
that's very Silicon Valley, right? Like, I just, you know, there's all these VC companies investing money that I just don't think you heard before. I mean, maybe they didn't put out a press release about it, but I think it's really interesting, like the investment in Sweetgreen.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that was a huge investment.
Sweetgreen, I think, but you've seen it slow down a bit because fast casual has become more saturated. And I think when we talk about tech, it's just a thesis of funding. So you are expected to grow exponentially when you take that VC money at those stages. And so I think it's hard because it's brick and mortar and all of that. But there's a lot of funding that's going into CPGs and disrupting all of the packaged goods, right? Like, that is very different than a more of a service-based industry. But there are a lot of companies that came from Silicon Valley that said, we're going to bring you food faster and we're going to do this and this. And those just...
I mean, if I told you how many times I got a call about a new app that is either going to cut costs for a restaurant or cut costs for the consumer... And I'm always like, this has been done, and it failed. Like, I don't know what do you think you're bringing to the table?
And most of them have never worked in a restaurant.
Right. They just think they have an idea.
Yeah, I was like, you know, Kingsley, I'm like, you got to speak CFO, like speak finance. Mm-hmm. And like, it's all about labor and operations. And like, we talk about case studies, and this is what it will cost you. This is how you profit versus like, we're going to get you more people at the wrong time. Like, no, that's not what restaurants need.
Well, so I want to talk about the fact that you have an all-women board.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, why have a board? And then, was that because of what's going on here in DC? Because you did work with Mike Isabella for a short time. Is that something that you put in place because of that? Or were you like ahead of the game?
Well, I'd like to think we're ahead of the game. So we have a great group, board of advisors. So it's an advisory group of women that, you know, have been hand selected and call upon to give great advice. I mean, I think at this stage in my career, you have to seek out the changes that you want. And part of that, too, is like there's not a lot of women in positions to advise. And so we have to create opportunities for each other. And so in the investment community, for instance, 2% of women get venture funding. And
which is amazing.
And that,
it's just amazing.
And that means that
most... Is it because they're not asking? I mean, why is it?
It's a whole world of issues. One is, yeah, women are not great. There's not as many, I would say, female founders to fund. And I think if you're a female partner at a VC, you're also looked at and scrutinized more with your deals. And there's a lot to talk about. And I think you have to make a choice where you can make it an issue or you can put your head down and just do the work.
So without naming names, what sort of women did you go after for your board? I mean, doing what are their backgrounds?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so we have someone who's a CFO at America's Test Kitchen, who I've known since I was 5. Who's fantastic, Ellen Kim, who works at Alex Partners with all the major restaurant groups, who's in mergers and acquisitions, Irene Chang Britt, who was president of Pepperidge Farm, Amanda Ruisi, who I've known since high school, who's like a publicist. It's just different skill sets that, you know, you build people around you who can fill in gaps. And it was really important because I knew we were not going to be able to bring in female investors.
Okay.
So I looked and sought out an investor group that, you know, we are, that had 50% of their portfolio was female founders, and half of them were not white. So it was really important. We ended up with, I'd say, probably the best investor we could in group, and their thesis of funding, and they've backed Time Hop and Foursquare, and you know, they have, they kind of let us do what we want. So it's been nice to have them on board. And
as investors, do they assist in laying out long-term goals for you? Because I assume you're looking to break out of the DC metro area eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we have
to
figure
it out.
Yeah,
we're going to Philly, aren't we?
That's right. Everyone has a city they want us to come to.
Right.
And we do get, you know, we get chefs from around the country asking when we're coming.
Sure.
Which always makes our day. And then we're like, oh, it's going to be a long time before we get there. But no, I mean, right now we're at the stage of like, we really want to figure it out. We have no problem having restaurants come to us in DC. Like, we could launch with 50 tomorrow. It's really about doing this in a very staged and deliberate way so we can really figure it out, because it takes time for people to get interested in new concepts and move off
of
sandwiches.
It's also important not to scale. I mean, there's nothing worse than being a glutton at a banquet table, and you know, you get so much in your mouth that you can't even swallow or digest it. So a lot that, but that happens to a lot of startups where they've stood up the business and people like it, and all of a sudden everybody's beating down their door, and it's like, it's almost like you get so, you know, you start inhaling your own fumes and you build the business too fast, and then it implodes because you can't handle the volume.
Yeah, I mean, I spend a lot of time saying no,
but it sounds like you can handle the volume.
We are today. Yes. The last 2 months, we have, you know, we got our fund aid at the end of December, and we have we're building out our team currently to be able to handle what we have now, and you know, for the next year. So that is important, and that's, you know, why we have Kingsley here now, because a year ago we would not have been able to bring someone like Kingsley into the business.
So who does the outreach to the restaurants? Is that more Kingsley or no?
We both go in tandem. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So you both.
So essentially, Sarah's the vision. I'm kind of like the numbers and kind of the
serious guy.
Oh, he's the reality guy.
Boots to the ground. Yeah. So, but you know, I think the really important thing about all of this is that we really care about the partners within our portfolio. At the end of the day, right? You know, we're not looking to just onboard anybody. You know, we're really looking at the brands that people really enjoy and that they can get behind and that really can provide quality food.
Well, and I'm with you on that, but I guess let me ask just another question about the partners you're working with. Do you find, like, what happens if you find that one of your partners, like, nobody's ordering from, like, moving forward? Like, let's say you had a partner and nobody was ordering from it. Would you be like, clearly they're not, like, would you advise them? Would you be like, well, they're not ordering. Like, it's nothing we can do about it. Like, how would you handle that?
It's a good question. I would like to think that at this point we have a good vetting process of what, there is no shortage of people wanting lunch in different types. People want variety. So, you know, it's figuring out that we're not going to take on 5 Mexican restaurants. We'll take on 1 or 2.
Sure.
Right? So it's within that grouping, that category. But I think if we ever got to that point, and at the same time, too, is it worth it for the restaurants to partner with us?
Well, I would also think that it would be important as a part of your vetting process that they have the ability to handle orders.
Like, absolutely.
Do they all have, like, does any of them say to you, listen, we can do X amount a day? Like, this is what we're capable of doing. And how far in advance do people have to order?
Yeah, so it's a 40-hour window. And the reason for that, it's taken 2 years to get down to that window. So Monday by 6 p.m., your order has to be in for Wednesday. We see an average lead time. Generally, the larger the group, the more lead time you're going to get. So we'll see about 5 days on average. Most of the restaurants we work with, it's a creating a good problem of too many lunches.
So, and in terms of outreach to companies that would place these large, you know, these group orders, are you even bothering anymore? Is it so word of mouth driven?
I wish.
So how do you do it?
So, you know, we've gone through different types of sales. So part of it is we work with the restaurants to market.
Sure.
We have, and we're building out our sales team. I mean, I got our first 75 clients by calling. And so I still do that.
Right.
And, you know, we have been small and deliberate, but we are, you know, we're hiring for sales if anyone is,
anybody's interested.
Anyone's out there. Yeah.
All right. Well, so
you need another job, don't you?
Yeah, sure. Nope. I only have 5. Why not take another one? All right. Well, let's. It's almost the end of the show. So,
last question. Wait, I got
okay,
one.
Okay, go ahead.
Why is it plum relish?
Oh, good question.
Thank you. See, she was going to say, "Oh, your questions suck," but why is it plum relish?
Oh gosh, how much time do we have?
Not that much,
honestly. So, I started this with my. I had a co-founder at the time, and we're still really, very good friends. And
sure you are.
Yeah, that's but what we all say. I had a co-founder, too.
I invited her, actually, to say
she's
hello.
In the
her
river
co-founder's
somewhere.
Buried in our
she's
backyard.
You guys are brutal. No, she's fantastic. But when we were going through names, it's one thing we were having trouble with. So we like consulted out, like, someone help us. And they came back with these names that were like Relish. For like, that's been used. It's really hard to, you know, sign up for. And so we decided to build a business now, you either have to have two words or made up one at this point to get a domain.
Where is that written? But okay.
She's like, that's what we found.
Yeah.
You asked a question and she gave you an answer.
Well, then you're out of business because you're the list are you on.
I know. Mine is so friggin' long, but that was 15 years
okay,
ago.
Okay.
So basically, we put a color in front of it and she called me up and she's like, I got the name. It's Plum Relish, like a plum job, you know,
right,
for corporate.
Plum job. Yeah.
And it's a verb and it's a noun, and relish is a verb and a noun, and it's like a special thing. And I was like, that is the dumbest effing name.
You can take it back on this show, but that's okay.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, you went with it.
And I woke up the next day, I was like, that is so good. Like,
good.
I really love it.
Meanwhile, she said, I'm not going to be your partner anymore. I'm out. The hell with you.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works.
All right. No, well, listen, how do we reach you online?
Plumrelish.com. You can place an order anytime. You can live chat with us. You can go to the respective like Founding Farmers, their website, Lunch Catering.
So all of your partners, if you want lunch catering, it's through Plum Relish.
And it's on all their websites.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So cool. It's on their websites too. Excellent. All right. We want to thank you both for joining us today. Next time, you can't be this chatty.
I'm sorry.
You can't.
No, but I mean, you know, it is nice. A lot of times we meet people and they've already rocketed to, you know, like the top of the mountain. You're on your way, but you're still close enough to sort of the idea and to starting. It's really interesting to hear how it
and exciting
sort of got going. Yeah, it's cool.
Well,
we want to thank you both for joining us today. Next week's show is going to be pretty fabulous as well. We'll be discussing culinary diversity through diplomacy. We're going to have embassy chefs and some ambassadors in studio talking about how embassy chefs work in the D.C. market.
Well, there's a big competition coming,
Well, there
too.
Is, but it's not really about the competition. Yeah. It's really about how the embassy chefs work
so
around the city.
So do you have in front of you which chefs from which embassies?
I don't.
You're bad, but
no,
okay.
No, actually,
and
I
we covered a little
doing.
Of that on Foodie and the Beast last week. It was a ton of fun.
Actually, it was yesterday.
It seems like last week.
It was yesterday.
Well, it wasn't. No, it wasn't.
Anyway, how about letting me finish? Okay.
Moldova, Liechtenstein.
Okay. Anyway, we want to thank you all for listening today. This was a fabulous show talking about your lunchtime dining with Plum Relish. So if you have corporate events and things of that nature, maybe this is something that you should investigate. This is David and Nikki Nellis, Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. We thank you for joining us. We're at the gorgeous Line Hotel. We'll be here again next Monday. Have a delicious week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.